Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God. And the Kingdom of God inculcates almost every single possible subject there is, because the Kingdom of God is the universe itself. So that doesn't leave much out. if you include everything that is this universal thing that we are in contact with through our senses, through touch and feel and smell and vision and our experience here on this earth and in this universe. We've been going through these seven questions that were put to me by someone in South Africa and trying to come up with a solution as to, you know, what can they do? There's a great many people that see violence rising up amongst the people. We see the same thing actually taking place in the United States. The demographics of that violence is slightly different because, of course, the demographics in South Africa is that the vast majority of the people are of the Negroid race. That those people are not all identical in those communities. There's different tribes. But even the tribes are not all identical. The members of the tribes, you know, all Zulus are not necessarily Zulu violent, you know, like we see in the movies that are going to drive out the white settlers. And that was one of the things that we talked about in the previous shows, is that there were two groups of whites that came to, I mean, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of different groups. But the reality, if you want to group people, which I don't really want to do, there were the Dutch who came there, and they were settlers, and there were the English who came there for the most part, and they were colonists. And there's a difference between the two. In fact, the Zulus were also coming there to South Africa, and they were settlers. And they both have a history. And if you look at whose history was more violent, more invasive, more destructive, it was clearly the Zulus. But you still cannot group all Zulu people, descendants of the Zulu tribes, into some sort of barbaric group, because barbarism is an individual choice. It's often made because of the fact that people lose their individuality in what is now, today, you might call identity politics. They lose their individual identity in a tribalism of some sort. And so it's my tribe, right or wrong, and people go out and massive armies are moved into the high plateau and kill millions of people. And that was done by the Zulus because they centered around a king, and if you opposed him, you died. And they had a cultural practice of following their king and following this power structure in their society. There was a different structure in the white settlers that came by way of the Dutch. And of course, there were English, there were Indonesian, there were lots of different people who came to South Africa. They mixed readily, and they made choices, and they got along pretty well for the most part. But we have these different, you can call them factions or groups that are in South Africa that are now, we see a large amount of violence rising up in their rhetoric. And to some degree, we see it actually taking action. And they're actually, you know, people are being killed and people are being murdered. As bad as apartheid was, generally speaking, there wasn't a lot of the abuses that people would like to think that somehow, you know, it wasn't like the worst example of white and black slavery in the United States. And even that, people do not take the time to find out actually what was going on. Something I've pointed out many times, I'm not in favor of slavery. I realize that it's a part of human history. Indians enslaved people, blacks enslaved people, whites enslaved people, Chinese enslaved people. People enslaved people. People, you know, somebody, Sam Harris was saying the other day that the slavery is bad. Well, what is slavery? Slavery is when you make somebody work, but you don't pay them for their work. They have to work just to maintain their status, and the value of their labor goes to somebody else without their choice. You know, they are compelled to work, but somebody else gets the profit of their work, not because they chose to give it, but because they were forced to give up the value of their labor to a third party without, or a second party, without their consent or choice. That's slavery. And of course, today, in most countries, all the citizens of those countries are enslaved. They're enslaved by government. They're forced to give up a portion. Almost every country has some form of income tax. If you earn it, a portion of it will be taken away from you by force and given to the government. That's slavery. Well, I don't care. You know, slaves in America were paid. That was very common. They were paid. They were not paid for all their labor. They were given a stipend. Priests and a lot of different religious groups that have ministers under a vow of poverty, everything they earn goes to the order. And a portion of what they earn may come back to them and help provide for them and take care of them. That's a form of slavery. It's a voluntary slavery because theoretically, it's not always the case in these different religious orders, they are considered servants of God, and so everything they make belongs to God. Now, how that order is organized, is there a hierarchy in that order where the order is exercising authority over its members, and so therefore they are simply taking from all their members, and this hierarchy is doling out in a trickle-down sort of way, and so therefore they get to sit on golden thrones and in nice fancy accommodations with a chef and all these kinds of things. And the other workers in the order are just forced to work. And they may be taken care of, but they don't have any way or recourse of determining where the value of their labor goes because they are subordinates within the order. That order would be an order where there's a hierarchy where they exercise authority one over the other. Of course, Christ refuted that concept and said that his church, appointed by him and his ministers, were not to exercise authority one over the other. They were given the mission of feeding and caring for the people, and that was, you know, feed my sheep, but they were not allowed to force the contributions of the people. That's a different concept than what we see in most countries of the world, because most people are content with the idea of forcing the contributions of their neighbor in order to guarantee their safety. So this morning, we answered a number of these questions that were put to us. We talked briefly about the Mark of the Beast. We have a detailed study of the Mark of the Beast on the website at preparingyou.com. That's preparingyou.com. And you just look up Mark of the Beast, and there's a detailed study there. I think I have some audios that I can put on that page that will help describe a great deal of those things. We went briefly over some of the basics. The Mark of the Beast is not a microchip. There's no evidence that it's a microchip. It's bad translations, poorly, you know, I'm not even going to say bad translations, but at least translations that slightly steer you away from what the author is really talking about. And the reality is that the mark of the beast is simply the antithesis of the mark of God. And the mark of God is the character of Christ dwelling in you as a part of your very psyche. It's not just a cultural wardrobe that you put on. It is that you are coming in the name of Christ because it's written on your heart to be a servant to all mankind, to not be a judge, not be a ruler over people, but a servant to people. Because that's what Christ came to serve, not to rule over you. The mark of the beast is the antithesis of that. So it's not that you come to serve, you come to make others serve you. You want to tax this group and force them to comply with you and serve you. There's a movement in South Africa amongst some of the whites who saw long before apartheid ended that this was, or begin to see at least, that this idea of forcing a certain class of society to work for a kind of a menial reward was not really a healthy way to organize a society. And so therefore they considered everybody had to work, no exceptions. Everybody had to contribute, and they were willing to do the menial tasks themselves. Now, that's a good idea. It isn't really the essentialness of the problem. The unwillingness to do that maybe is, because it encourages pride and arrogance and vanity if you're not willing to do the menial tasks, which of course is why Christ was getting down on his hands and knees and washing the feet of the apostles. You had to set aside that pride and arrogance in order to, you had to literally sacrifice your life in order to have a life more abundant. So you had to be willing to serve in order to have the power and authority that was Christ. Christ had power and authority, but he didn't use it to oppress others. And of course, I'm not saying that the Dutch and the Afrikaners was going there to oppress people, because clearly their history was not really that intention at all. They underwent tremendous hardships to get to where they were. Same way with most Americans. They didn't come here to oppress the Indians and enslave the Indians or rob the Indians or steal from the Indians. There were some that were absolutely willing to do that, but there were Indians who were absolutely willing to do that to other Indians and to whites if they could get away with it. The reality is there are good and bad people on both sides, and most Americans were not coming here as colonists. They were coming here as settlers. I don't know if I can honestly say most. At different periods of time in history, most were coming here to settle, not to colonize. And certainly, once the American Revolution took place, many of the Hessians who were sent over here to oppress the Americans, Indians and whites and whoever were here, they were sent over by Great Britain to oppress and to control the American populace, something that really the king didn't have a right to do, which is another whole long story, because of the fact that America that had created certain charters that had allowed them certain freedoms that were available. And this was even argued by high up authorities within the parliament, that the king could impose many of these taxes that he was imposing anywhere else in his realm, but not in America, because there had been concessions made in order to get America inhabited by British subjects. And now by the usurpation of the king, where he was seizing a use that was not his, taxing a tax that was not his to tax, that the people had a right to stand up and say, we're going to throw off this tyranny. And it wasn't really, the one who was revolting was not Americans. The one who was revolting, I mean, surely there were some Americans who were revolting and probably quite the rebel, but the reality is what they were doing was throwing off an oppressor, because the king was revolting against previous agreements. That's almost never taught in the schools, but it was the common argument, and you can even see it written in the Declaration of Independence. It wasn't about simply rebelling against proper authority. It was the proper authority was seizing the use. Today, many people complain about the authoritarian governments around them, but in many cases, the authority of those governments have been created because people desired to exercise authority over their neighbor. So what I'm saying is that in South Africa, in the United States, in Alaska, and Canada, and Australia and wherever you're at, that if you put certain principles first in choosing your actions on a day-to-day basis, that it will alter your status. Eventually, it will alter your status in society. It will lend you a protection in society that you cannot get any other way. I just heard Jordan Peterson talking, and he was saying that let's see if I can actually pull it up here, because I actually took a note and wrote it down, that where he was talking about the well-developed individual is the antidote to tyranny. And so what do you do? You know, Jordan Peterson has the 12 rules against chaos, or whatever it is. His book is 12 rules book. What? And it, he has a number of rules, you know, like stand up straight, make your bed, clean up your room, which are metaphors for, you know, clean up your own act, get your own house in order. And so what do you do after you make your bed? I mean, what should you be trying to do in a society to combat the possibility of tyranny? Well, we talked earlier in this series about what brings tyranny, that if you are accustomed to living at the expense of your neighbor, whether it's, you know, through apartheid, where you're taking advantage of large numbers of cheap labor that is coming from the black community, which everybody in South Africa were not doing, but some were doing, that's going to weaken society. But any kind of socialism, if you're in a completely all-white or all-black society and you want to tax the rich, force the rich to provide a welfare system for the poor, force, by force, as soon as you want to do that, then it automatically begins to alter the very spiritual nature of your society, the very, very soul of society. And now, today, you know, there's 20 years, 50 years ago, there was no debate that socialism was bad in America. If you go back 50 to 100 years ago, let's go back to 1930, which isn't quite 100 years ago. If you go back to that, democracy was considered bad in America. Yeah, you go to our page on democracy, and we will show you the actual definition of democracy in the Army Field Manual in 1927. And it was not a good thing. Democracy was a bad thing. And that's the way it was defined. And if you go back to 200 years ago or more to the Founding Fathers, most of them opposed democracy. They were not in favor of democracy. They did not create a democracy. There is some democratic appearance of the Constitution of the United States, but they created a republic. The problem today is most people, if you mention the word republic, they think a republic is something that actually is an indirect democracy. And that's not what a republic is. In a republic, the leaders are titular. What most people think of a republic today is an indirect democracy where you elect leaders who are lawmakers. They're not representative. They're not titular. They're rulers. They will compel the offerings of the people. They will subjugate the people. They will regulate the people, because you're not in a republic. You're in an indirect democracy. One of the things that Jordan Peterson advocates all the time is, be careful in your speech. Well, the only way to really be careful in your speech, at first anyway, is to find out what the definition of words are. And so that's why we're always going back to the definition of words. Today, religion is defined as what you think about a supreme being. 200 years ago, religion was the pious performance of your duty to God and your fellow man. So the performance of a duty is not an opinion. It's, you may have an opinion about what that duty is, but religion was actually the performance of that duty. It wasn't just what you think. And it really sells amongst modern Christians and modern churchgoers that if you have the right opinion, you're saved. And if you say the right words, you're saved. Christ said nothing like that whatsoever. And really, that contradicts the teachings of Paul and Peter and James. Because they're saying what you do. They're saying if these people do this, 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 and this, have nothing to do with it because they have no inheritance in the kingdom. Yet, even though that's very clear in many of the things that Paul says, and he repeats it more than once, people go around saying all you have to do is believe in Jesus and you're automatically saved. It doesn't matter what you do. There's actually people saying you could be a murderer and a rapist and a robber and all these things, but if you've accepted Christ, you're saved. If that isn't a piece of rationalization, it's unbelievable. What I'm saying is that I agree with Peterson that the development, the righteous development of the individual as a virtuous individual and human being, I don't like necessarily the word human being, but as, an individual rather than a person, even the word person and individual are not necessarily interchangeable. So trying to be precise in my speech, to virtuously develop the individual is the antidote to tyranny. It's also the any kind of tyranny. It's an antidote to foreign invasion. It's an antidote to tyranny. It's an antidote to criminalization of a community. It's an antidote to actually even good bad health, disease and plagues, etc. So how do you do that? How do you develop the individual to become a virtuous individual? And of course, the churches were engaged in that a couple hundred years ago. They talk about it now, but they're not really engaged in it. Because, well, to some degree, they give it some token preference. But if 80 to 90 or more percent of the welfare of your society is provided by men who exercise authority, what the heck is your church doing? How are you fulfilling your duty to your God and your fellow man if you do it by forcing your neighbor to contribute to your welfare and the welfare of others? And even, when people were trying to take care of some of the needs and bolster up the black community and help the black community reach an equal providence in South Africa, they were trying to do it by taxing the people through a centralized government. When Israel sought a centralized government, they sought a king, a ruler, somebody who could exercise authority, a chief executive officer. When they were trying to do that, that was called a rejection of God. It was not only a rejection of God, but it was the result of having already rejected God. And so there's a lot of things that we could talk about, a lot of things we were talking about, Marcus Aurelius and Antoninus Pius and Justin, what the early Christians were doing. They were gathering once a week. We point out in several places that it was very clear that the Christian community, where there was gatherings, often were in homes, sometimes in larger groups. Certainly Pentecost was a Christian gathering because they all started following Christ at Pentecost. When they were doing that, they were changing the course of society. And that they were repenting, they were changing the way they think of how they were going to provide the welfare of society, was in this system of tens, hundreds, and thousands through the process of charity. So therefore, in order to do that, they had to create these congregations of tens, or companies, as it's often translated in the King James Bible. They were to sit down in companies of tens, and those tens were to gather in tens also, so that would be a company, a rank of a 100. And then because there were 5,000 people there on one particular day, which was probably far more than 5,000, that was because it was the heads of families that were representing those numbers. So there was 50, a rank of 50 of those 100, so that's 5,000. 5,000 people sat down in these small companies, linked together in these ranks, in these patterns. It was one of the most common forms of self-government throughout the history of mankind. And lo and behold, that's when there were enough loaves and fishes for everybody to eat. And from then on, whenever they talk about the duties of the church, whether it was in the temple or elsewhere, they were rightly dividing the bread, the Eucharist, the thanksgiving, from house to house. And you know, we've written books about this. We've written pamphlets about it, articles about it. And it's covered in the Thy Kingdom Comes, where the ancient altars of Israel were not about piling up stones and killing sheep and setting sheep on fire. The stones from the beginning, the original altars that were being set up, were actually altars of men. And we have a lot more on this. We have a lot already published. We're going to have more published on this. And it was these altars were actually institutions of charity. And that you gave your sacrifices to those men who formed those altars. They had to be men who came together. See, the same word for a gathering of stones is the same word for a council of men or a council of friends. And so those altars were councils of friends. And so when you gave your offering to those men individually, and they were gathered together in these companies and ranks, they could redistribute what was given freely to them to the needy of society. And the long-range outcome of this is that the people would actually be bound together in the case of enemies come into the community, invade the community. They conquered Sodom and Gomorrah, and they took away Abraham's nephew. And suddenly, all the people where Abraham had helped them set up these altars were willing to drop everything they were doing, put together an army overnight. They were able to muster this army overnight. They didn't have to say, okay, now let's get some companies together, let's get some battalions together, let's get some platoons together, and then you guys will be in charge and we'll appoint this officer. They already were ready to go because they already had a network based on charity. And so they already knew who each other were. They already knew how to be in contact. People don't realize this, but they were doing this at the time of the American Revolution. All that's been removed from your history books. The tens, hundreds, thousands, they called it. The tithings. That when, you know, Paul Revere and the others who were going out to spread the news that the British were coming, they were going out and notifying certain men in each community, and those men went out and notified everybody else. They were already able to instantly, the next day, have their platoons and their companies and their battalions put together with men who knew each other and had an invested interest in each other, cared about one another, and had the bonds of, you know, the bands of brotherhood, you know, that you see in movie The Band of Brothers, where these guys developed that bands of brotherhood over the period of time when they were in basic training and AIT, and then when they were paradropped into Normandy, and then so by the time they get farther into things like the Battle of the Bulge, they're already committed to one another. They're a band of brothers. But see, Abraham created this system of charity, taking care of all the social welfare needs of these people through this institution of altars of charity, free will offering altars, and men of service who man them. So they've already filtered out those who really do a good job, really care about one another. They know in their own community who they can trust and who they don't trust. They were already had that all established so that when an army comes through and takes Sodom and Gomorrah and takes Abraham's nephew captive and all the other people and the gold and silver, all that they could take, Abraham was able to muster an army overnight that defeated them overnight. It wasn't because they piled up stones and killed sheep together. It was because they had created an institution of charity to sustain their society where everybody was empowered as individuals within that society. Because that system of tens, hundreds, and thousands promotes the character of the individual. You know, the guy who doesn't give much, the guy who brings, you know, wilted vegetables instead of what would really be a value to everybody. Everybody knows who he is. And he knows everybody knows who he is. And he has to take a look at the fact that he is bringing, you know, a gimpy lamb to the sacrifice instead of the good stuff. So it becomes paramount in society, that your hierarchy, your natural hierarchy of honor, not any contractual rule, just the respect that your neighbors are going to pay you, the esteem that they're going to hold you in, is going to rise as you share. Whether you're a rich man or a poor man, if you're a poor man and you share, they see, oh, like who gave more? Like the widow's mite. The rich man who gave half of everything he had, or the widow who gave everything she had. People know that. And these create bonds in society. And so the rich men are, if they, you know, when in the old days, when law enforcement was in the hands of the people in the community, and when you were robbed, everybody, you know, there was a hue and cry, and everybody had to come out to your, to protect you, to get back what you were being robbed of. They were going to do that because they respected you and honored you and cared about you. Well, how does a rich man get people to care about him? Just be rich? Have real fancy clothes? A real nice house? They might envy him, but that doesn't make them admire him. But if he takes what he has, the surplus of what he has, and he is sharing it, and he's showing genuine care about the needy of society, then the people will come to his aid and will defend him and defend his property with their own lives. And of course, that's what happened in Abraham's case. Abraham was a man who gave and helped other people learn how to give and helped people learn how to come together. He would not take the position as ruler in Haran. He left that to Nahor, his brother. He realized that it was not that I was in Ur, which became an unjust totalitarian dictatorship, and now I'm in Haran. I don't want to be this top-down ruler at all. I want to be a leader of free men and build up the individuals in my community, not oppress them with taxation, but to create these altars of charity. So, if you're in any society, anywhere, the more you turn around and move that other way to take care of one another through a system of charity, that doesn't mean every time you see somebody on the street corner with a sign that says they need food, you just hand them $20. No, this was organized. Early Christians were feared by the emperors because of their union and discipline, because they were so well organized. Not because they were any threat to actually take them over, but it made them look bad. It frightened them that somebody could be that organized. And that's where Christians were getting persecuted. So I haven't even read the question that was put to me by the fellow from South Africa, who, you know, if you go to our website at Preparing You, you can join the African email group, and you can get in touch with others in South Africa, and possibly over all of Africa. Right now, we have one group covering all of Africa. But if South African people were to gather together, they can start these organizations of tens, hundreds, and thousands. These are free assemblies. You don't sign up and become some sort of obligated member. It's this, you know, you think about it. How does this work? And I've told the story many times, going back to a little town in North Dakota where my grandfather had died. I never met my grandfather. He died before I could ever meet him. I think he died before I was even born. Or at least, he died, so I never even met him. And had a heart attack and died. But when I met the people in that little town of North Dakota, one of them was talking about praising, and he hadn't really met my grandfather either, but his father knew my grandfather, and from what he heard from his father, my family held high esteem for my family because of the fact of what that man had done. And he said as long as there was food in his grocery store, there was food on the table of my grandmother. And he was adamant about this, emotionally adamant about it. Yet we had never met. I had never met my grandfather. I don't believe he had ever met my grandfather. But the actions of my grandfather were now going from generation to generation and offering protection from generation to generation. You don't get that with a bureaucracy. You get that with a network of people who are learning to care about one another as much as they care about themselves. They understand that loving their neighbor is an essential part of a strong society. So that's where we need to go. And the seventh question, the last question that was put to me, and actually some of these questions were actually like double questions, it says, many Christians believe that it is God's will for believers to submit to the state. Another way of saying that is submit to government. But does God really expect us to submit to tyrants such as Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Castro? Well, these tyrants come about because of changes in society. Hitler was the leader of a social democracy. A lot of people complain about calling this person or that person Hitler today, or Nazis. And the reality is that most of the people yelling that, punch a Nazi, they're all democratic socialists, extreme socialists. In the same way with Stalin, and I don't mention Stalin too much, but he killed as many people as Hitler killed. And he was a communist, which is just an extreme form of socialism. I mean, that Karl Marx was all for democracy because democracy leads to socialism. He was all for socialism because socialism leads to communism. But all these systems have led to death and oppression because you're empowering somebody to take away from your neighbor what you want for yourself. And that is just biblically incorrect. So the fact, if you're already under a Hitler or Stalin or Mao or Castro, chances are you've been doing something wrong for a long time. These people are a product of your choices and your parents' choices. The kingdom of God is from generation to generation. That's what it says in the Bible. Well, the kingdom of hell is from generation to generation too. Now, you want to change that. You're back in the bondage of Egypt. You have a totalitarian pharaoh, whether you call him Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Nimrod, Castro, whatever. You want to change that. You have to change your thinking. And you have to take that thinking and turn it into actions. You can do that right now. When we're talking about submitting to the state, well, we're talking about submitting, and they're taking that from quotes in Peter, and we have articles that show you some of those. Peter also said, better to obey God rather than men. But the fact is that if you're entangled again in the elements of the world and have gone under the authority of new masters because you have been spending generations coveting your neighbor's goods through the agency of these same governments, and now they're out of control, and now you're going to complain. The solution is to go back to that virtual relationship with community where what the church used to do is take care of the needy without the world. When it says pure religion, it only talks about religion once in a good sense in the Bible. Every other place that it mentions, which is only five times it mentions the word religion, it's talking about bad religion. The one time it talks about good religion or pure religion, they're saying taking care of the needy, unspotted by the world. And the word world that they use there is one of five different words that appear as world in the New Testament, is constitutional order or system of government. So you're supposed to be taking care of the needy unspotted by the world without the help of these constitutional orders that use force and violence and taxation to provide for the needy. If you can come together and start doing that, it will alter your thinking. It will alter the path of your society. It will change the culture of your society and therefore change the destiny of your society, because culture matters. We got away from that for the last 100 years or more, and we need to return to that, and that's what's called repentance. The Bible does teach, he goes on to say, the Bible teaches that the Son of God set us free, but I don't feel very free when I'm taxed 45% of my income and am forced to live under humanistic state laws. Well, that's what you deserve, is to be taxed like that. Those governments are allowed to punish the wicked, and for almost a century now, almost all these countries have been moving towards this idea of living at the expense of others. Now, I know many people that find themselves in these societies don't want to live at the expense of others. They don't want to apply for benefits. They don't want to apply for entitlements. They want to stand on their own. But if you don't care about the next guy as much as you care about yourself, then you're going to not be able to get out of this present bondage. You have to actually put that, you have to be that doer of the word. You have to start taking care of one another through faith, hope, and charity. Then we'll answer the last question, which was about Romans 13. So the last part of his question here, we'll get to that really quick so that we get done before the end of the hour, is that what was Paul trying to tell us in Romans 13? Well, Paul is probably one of the most misunderstood people in the New Testament. And there's all kinds of opinions about him because he was one of the most prolific, and we were told, Peter said that Paul's going to talk to you, my brother Paul, he says, is going to talk to you about things difficult to understand. Well, things difficult to understand are also easily misinterpreted, easily taken out of context, easily twisted to mean something other than what they really mean. Paul had been a Pharisee. He had been working for the Pharisaical government of Judea. He persecuted Christians because he found them to be rebels and opposing the government that he thought was the righteous government. And then all of a sudden it struck him on the road to Damascus that he was wrong. He was in error. And whatever the mystical event was where he was knocked off his high horse, so to speak, that he began to understand that what Christianity was really all about, and he ends up being one of its great defenders, even sacrificing himself for the well-being of other Christians, which he had caused the death of previously to this because he had ideas in his head about Judaism that were incorrect. He was sure they were right, but they were wrong, and he was willing to admit they were wrong. I had lots of ideas about Christianity. I grew up, went to seminaries, studied at St. Joseph College, and was asking lots of questions, got into a lot of trouble because I asked a lot of questions. But the reality is eventually I had to admit the ideas that I had come to accept were wrong. And I went back to my father when I first wrote the book Covenants of the Gods. I hadn't finished it yet, but I had the first chapter completed and more of it that was on its way. And I brought it back to him and I said, is this right? And he read it over. It took him hours to read this little tiny pamphlet, this first chapter, 5,000 word chapter. And he said, I was right. And he was a lawyer, summa cum laude, wrote law books. And he said that the Covenants of the Gods has a lot to do with law, the Bible, government. And it's explaining how the contractual nature of government, which is why God tells us to make no covenants with them nor with their gods. And if you listen to the previous show where I talked about who are the gods, many that Paul was talking about. See, you don't know these things because your ministers are not teaching you. The seminaries aren't teaching you. That's why I put 800 to 1,000 footnotes in one book alone so you can go and check it out for yourself. So now I'm coming along and telling you that preachers and their interpretation of Romans 13 is incorrect simply because they don't know what Paul was talking about. They don't know what Christ was talking about, that he was actually preaching a government, taking the government away from the Pharisees, appointing it to the apostles. And those apostles were the princes of that government, but they did not exercise authority, so people think that wasn't a government. Because they can't imagine that there's a government that operates on the perfect law of liberty, which Paul says there is, and James says there is. And they explain how it operates. And it requires you do certain things. And so did Christ, required that you do certain things. That you had to be this doer of the word. You had to actually turn your love for your neighbor into actual events and actions. So along comes, now, when he's writing to the Romans, who's he writing to? He's writing to people who are citizens of Rome. Roman citizens. He himself was not a Roman citizen. Most people don't want to believe that. And that they say, well, it says right there that he was a citizen of Rome. We have an article that shows you right from the biblical text that he was from Tarsus. Tarsus was an independent republic recognized by Rome. So he wasn't a Roman citizen. And he had a status called Romeos, which is a Greek word. A Roman citizen would be called Quirus. But Romeos, many Roman citizens were also Romeos. But Romeos is a status. It's where you have full possession of your rights. If you were to say that in Rome, you would say sui juris. But these are, you know, that seems very complicated, and we're trying to throw this out in a little hour-long show, which is why we have hundreds of pages and thousands of footnotes showing you where we're getting this from. Just look up Paul. Was Paul a Roman citizen? And you can read that article. But if we're going to look at Paul talking in Romans 13, he's writing Roman citizens who are living in Rome, who are have become Christians, and they're trying to operate as a Christian community, this Christian government, with private religion, private welfare, not going to the temples for the free bread of Rome and the welfare of Rome and the benefits of Rome and the unrighteous wages of Rome. But they're actually in this network of tens, hundreds, and thousands taking care of one another. But all the Jews that were Christians were just kicked out of Rome by Claudius. They were sent packing. They had to leave Rome. They were actually exiled from Rome. But they didn't exile the Romans because they were Romans. But they were doing the same thing those guys who were just exiled. So now they're saying, how do we do these things? And Paul is writing and explaining. Because Paul preached Christ first. He's not preaching a new gospel. Preaching the same gospel of loving one another, taking care of one another, sitting down in the tens, hundreds, and thousands, commanded by Christ. And they're doing this to be this government within Rome. And Rome eventually tried to persecute them, and then supposedly under Constantine tried to join them and do the same thing they were doing, but they didn't really do the same thing. What Constantine really was doing was starting the Church of Constantine. He wasn't really following Christ, and we explain that and show you that. But in Romans 13, Paul is saying, let every man remain subject to the higher power, because all power is of God. There is no power but of God, and anyone who opposes power opposes God. Right? So that's pretty clear, right? No, that's not really clear, because you don't know what word they're translating into power there. Once you know what word they're translating into power, then you'll have a different view, or you could have a different view. You might not. You might still hold on to what you already believe and think is true, but you could have a different view. And what Paul was actually saying, when he uses the word exousia, which is the word that means the right to choose, the power of choice. That's what that word means. There's lots of words that are translated into power. But the power of choice, the authority to make the choice yourself. Aristotle uses the same word and actually defines the same word as one of the strongest words in the Greek language for liberty. Because it's the liberty of choice. That if you give the power of choice to government, you elect the government's going to exercise authority, is going to force your neighbor to contribute to the benefit of society, then that same government is able to force you to contribute. And when you live that way long enough, it degenerates you where you don't, you know, if somebody has a need, you hear somebody in the street being raped or murdered or attacked, you say, that's the government's job. That's not your job, right? You don't have to run to his aid. And so people are attacked. Sometimes they're attacked by the government itself, and they're attacked by the courts. And you're so used to not coming to the aid of your neighbor that they get away with it. And you see this in Chicago and Baltimore. You see it all over the world where people are being attacked. You know, I have in-laws in Sweden through my son. And there was a film there where they were imitating somebody, like a woman being attacked in a car, and the windows were all fogged over. And it was actually a recording. A guy was just playing a recording and shaking the car like she's being attacked. She's yelling for help. Individual after individual after individual ran by the car. When they heard that, they left. They did not stop. And finally, two guys stopped, and they forced the door open and grabbed the guy and pulled him out to try to save the girl, and they couldn't find the girl, and they were starting to beat up on the guy. And the cameraman had to run out and say, hey, no, this is just a social experiment. There's no girl, nobody's getting hurt and everything. And they explained what they were doing, and then they hugged the guys because they were the first ones who finally came to their aid. And this is in Sweden. They used to be, the Vikings, the tough, but they didn't do it. Well, the tragic thing of it is these two guys who came to the aid of the girl weren't Swedish. They were French. What the heck is going on? There were some Swedish women who came to the aid, tried to do something about it, but the men weren't doing it. Now, I'm sure there are Swedish men who would come to the aid, but the reality is statistically this is absurd. But this comes from the idea. This is how you degenerate as a society. You've made your bed in the morning. You're standing up straight. You're going out into the world. Are you going out in the world with the intention of being of service to others or just become rich yourself? Are you going out in the world because you care about your neighbor as much as you care about justice? You care about righteousness for everybody. Is that your goal? And if that's your goal, then you get to choose as to what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. Now you're coming on, that same sentence in the Greek is actually in one translation, obey the government, for God is the one who has put it there. God did not put the government there. You put the government there. Your parents put the government there. That's the reality of what's happened. And so if we're going to look at that word exousia and understand that it means liberty, it means the right to choose, a right that was given to you by God, then that sentence there, those sentences there in Romans 13, 1 through 3, it says, let every soul be subject to the higher liberty, for there is no liberty but of God. And the liberties that be are ordained of God. And whosoever therefore resisteth the liberty, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive for themselves damnation, destruction, whatever you want to put there. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. So if you're going to have rulers, and you're going to covet your neighbor's goods, and you're going to desire to eat at the table of rulers, that they're going to set that table by taking away from your neighbor, then you better fear the evil, because they're going to become the Hitlers, the Maos, the Stalins, the Castros, the Nimrods, the Pharaohs of your life. So if you want to change that, you have to change the way you're doing things. Wilt thou not be afraid of the liberty? That's what it says. Are you afraid to gather together and depend upon faith, hope, and charity and that perfect law of liberty? Are you afraid of that? If you're not afraid of that, let's do that. Let's gather together. And that's why we created the network, so that people could do that, so that they could, all of the network groups are based on geography. We have more in America because that's where we started, but we have them in Australia. You have to start finding people who want to sit down together and care about their neighbor as much as they care about themselves. They care about their neighbor's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness as much as they care about their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. If all the churches were actually, instead of just creating country clubs or clubs, social clubs, where everybody feels good after they go to church, but we're actually going to church like that first century church we talked about this morning, where those that had shared with those that did not have enough. Not because there wasn't free bread around, but because Christians would not take of the free bread of men who exercised authority, because they knew that if they do that, It would make them merchandise and curse their children with debt. And if evil men came to power, they would oppress and kill them if they could. And so what you need to do is, wherever you're at, just simply start gathering in those free assemblies of tens, hundreds, and thousands. Not just in your neighborhood, but in the whole country and in other countries. Link those together. It's all about free choice, empowering the individual to exercise his responsibilities, not only for his family, but for his community and for that peculiar people we call the kingdom of God. So, and until you do that, you're going to be kind of on your own, because that's where you get the grace of God. That's where God is going to come into helping you, and his grace will begin to protect you. So until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.